From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
William James became America's first professor of psychology before Freud ever published a book. And James coined the phrase stream of consciousness before Joyce wrote a novel. He was the foremost American philosopher of the 19th century, and Robert Richardson joins me now to reveal the man behind the ideas. His book, William James in the Maelstrom of American Modernism, is published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm very pleased it has brought Robert Richardson back to my show today. Hi.
Nice to be here.
Last time we were talking about Emerson, and then this book was 10 years in the making. So were you thinking about Emerson and James at the same time?
Well, no, it took me 10 years to write Emerson, too, and it took 10 years to write the Thoreau book. I mean, in 30 years, I've just done three books. I'm slow.
What did you discover about the life of William James that previous biographers had missed?
Well, I think that I found out, or at least made a pretty good argument for the fact that it was William who was in love with Minnie Temple, who was the great prototype for the Henry James heroines, Daisy Miller and Millie Teal and all that. And people have always wondered about the love affair between Henry James and Minnie Temple. But I think it's pretty clear that it was William who was in love with her, and it changed his life.
But this book actually is an attempt to mix both the story and the intellectual ideas, and nobody's ever tried that before. And I understand you went so far as to read everything that William James read so that you could get inside his head.
Well, I read as much as I could.
What was it like growing up in the James family?
I think it must have been semi-controlled chaos. There were five children. William was the oldest. Henry, who became the novelist, was 15 months younger. Then there were two more boys, Wilkie and Bob. And then there was Alice, the youngest. But they were all within about 7 years stretch. And they all worked in one room at night, and the father wrote his long, endless, unwanted books on the living room table. And William one night drew a frontispiece for one of his father's books that showed a man beating a dead horse.
And they well, his father was a theologian.
The father was an independent theologian. He was a very wealthy man. He had inherited a huge amount of money from his father and never had to work a day in his life. He became fascinated with Fourierian socialism. He became fascinated with Swedenborgianism. He was always pursuing some kind of private Calvinism. He was a strange, blocked hierophant of a man. But he loved his children and lavished attention on them, but hauled them hither and thither and yon. He hauled them off to Europe and then back and then back to Europe and England and France and Germany and then Switzerland, trying to find schools, never satisfied. Back to America they would come. Growing up in the James family was helter-skelter.
On the other hand, it probably made them a lot more close-knit. We have some people who suggested that William's feelings towards his sister Alice were a little, well, not, you know, just they were a little too close, perhaps. He married a woman named Alice, didn't
he? He married a woman named Alice, and his son, William, married a woman named Alice. The James family used very few names. They got along with William, Henry, and Alice, basically.
And Alice was a lesbian, the sister. Henry, some people feel, perhaps, was a homosexual, at least in mind, if not always in action. So was that a part of this whole environment, or is that just an accidental thing?
No, I think there was a kind of there was certainly a systematic openness on the father's part. Henry James Sr. became fascinated with Fourierism and utopianism, and after he had married and had five kids, himself, he suddenly began to think that marriage wasn't such a great institution, and he began writing against it down here in New York. And his biographer thinks that's probably why he had to leave New York, because he was writing all these fiery newspaper articles attacking marriage as an institution, and thereby implicitly sort of backing a notion that relations between people should be affectionate. They should not be institutional. So the whole family grew up with that and then had to make their own ways.
William was closest to Henry, and Henry obviously is a psychological novelist. Do they share a lot of things?
They share an enormous number of things, I think. I had a wonderful chance to reread all of Henry's novels, which I love, and I found that whole set of novels, What Maisie Knew and The Tragic Muse, in there, which I had not read so carefully before. But William and Henry shared this upbringing. They shared the James family. But then Henry broke off and went to Europe and settled for the old world, settled for England, settled for Rome, and became quite different. And so they would grow apart for a while. But then the most fascinating thing for me was that as they got older and sicker, they pulled back together. And they were defending each other. Henry would write William and say, "I've always been a pragmatist. I'm pragmatizing." And William would finally write to Henry after he disapproved of the style of the late novels. Henry wrote a wonderful book called The American Scene about America. And William wrote, "You've really done it this time. It's a wonderful book." And so through sickness, and they both had heart problems at the end, they came closer and closer. It's a nice story ending.
James tried several careers before he settled on what he was to do. Painter, doctor, naturalist. Did those paths not taken play a role in shaping his thought?
Well, I think they had a huge role. John Dewey said that James escaped a standard classical education, and it was the making of him, because it protected him from received inert ideas and from safe conventional ways of thinking. So William's struggles, which are considerable down there, I think liberated him in many ways to be his own person.
You've written biographies of the two of the greatest thinkers of the 19th century American, anyway, Thoreau and Emerson. Where would you place William James among the intellectual currents of the 19th century?
Well, I started with the notion that James would be a kind of culminating figure from Thoreau and Emerson, and then I very quickly discovered that that's not really the right way to look at it for me, because James comes out of science, he comes out of Darwin, he comes out of physiology, he comes out of mathematics and an interest in sort of pure science. There's not a Platonic bone in William James.
But interestingly, he was quite popular, partly because he had a very straightforward style of writing so people could understand him. Has that led some contemporary scholars to underestimate him?
Well, there's a tendency to think so. I mean, James, it has been said, is so easy to read, but he's difficult to understand. John Dewey is almost impossible to read, but he's easy to understand. James is constantly getting in trouble because he writes so well that people tend to write him off and say, "Oh, it's just that he's such a good writer." Well, that's huge, though.
How was his work received in Europe?
It was received quite well in Europe by most people, and this is partly because William was very fluent in German, and in fact so fluent in French that he delivered a major talk in French that he had just written over the weekend before going to a major conference. So the fact that he could speak the major research languages of Europe gave him an edge, and European scholars took him seriously. He had also lived abroad a good deal, understood Europe more than many.
And wasn't Mussolini an admirer of his writings?
There's a kind of funny debate about that, and the best I've been able to make out of that is that Mussolini was told that he should admire some of William James's things that he got through Papini, an Italian pragmatist, and that it's not a very informed connection.
My guest is Robert D. Richardson, whose latest biography is William James and the Maelstrom of American Modernism, which is published by Houghton Mifflin. Well, he's a philosopher. I guess he's best remembered as a philosopher, but he was a psychologist. And what does being a psychologist mean at that time. When we look at his work, do we see any connections to what we think of as the psychology to come, Freud and Adler and Jung and the rest?
Well, there are connections, though there are also major divergences. What William James was interested in was the mind. And initially he took up physiology and dissected the brain. And then he took up psychology, which is about how the mind actually works. And then you take up philosophy, which is what the mind does. So all three of these things really are unified and hung together. But he's early in psychology. He's interested in experimental psychology. His idea would be to take somebody and lay them on a plank with a fulcrum and then start reciting Milton to them. And as he started reciting Milton to them, the head would sink lower and lower and lower, thus proving that it takes blood in the brain and you get heavier as you think about something interesting. So he would take people in a swing and twist them all up and then let them swing loose and then try to walk because he became interested in inner ear disturbances and seasickness. So there's a very practical, technical, experimental side to all this. But it keeps him anchored when he turns to philosophy because he wants always to know how the mind actually works, meaning how does the brain work, how do the senses work.
How did he come to coin the phrase stream of consciousness?
I am not sure that he actually coined it, but he is certainly the first to use it. Maybe he did coin it. I haven't been able to pin that down. But the idea was that consciousness is not an entity. It's not a thing. It's a process. And so over and over through his life, he would work in metaphors to try and describe the mind as a river, as a stream, as a flow, as event, not as something fixed.
I wonder if that had any impact on Gertrude Stein, one of the people he mentored.
I think it had an enormous impact on Gertrude Stein, and she labored all her life to sort of dig herself out from the suggestion that she was just following William James in this. But she did experiments for him when she was a student of his in Cambridge on automatic writing, the idea there being under hypnosis, can you get at a layer in people that you can't otherwise?
How did he come to be a mentor to W.E.B. Du Bois?
Du Bois came to Harvard to study philosophy with William James, came from the South, and was very glad he did. James welcomed him.
James wrote several variations on the idea that the person who thinks positively will get a positive outcome. Was that theory related, do you think, to his personal battles with depression?
I think it was. He gives us an example of somebody caught climbing in the Alps, and you get stuck in a place where you can't quite reach the next step. It's going to take a little jump. And he says, if you believe that you can't make it, your chances of failure increase. If you believe that you can make it and you take the jump, your belief will strengthen you and you might make the jump. And in this case, belief creates what it wants.
Well, it sounds like if he were alive today, he might also be a motivational speaker.
Well, he was sort of a motivational speaker before there was such a thing. He made the circuit and talked at colleges and did particularly a group of talks at women's colleges. And they were received rousingly. And he did very deeply believe that we all have energies that we don't use every day and that can be got to.
When he, I'm not sure I know what he meant when he said, we don't laugh because we're happy because we laugh. That seems counterintuitive to me.
It is. It's the beginning of the sort of famous James Lang theory of emotion that is still has a fair amount of credence. And what it argues is that an emotion is not something that you start with that you then create in action. He says we are afraid because we're running from the bear. It's a physiological reaction to turn and start to run. And there's no thinking and no emotion involved in that at all. But once you start to run, you become afraid. And there are certain situations in which after your first initial response, what you say you're peeling onions and you start to your eyes water up, you can start to feel sad, even though there's nothing to feel sad about. The emotion follows the event.
Now, he was working at a time when there was a lot of intellectual ferment, and we had Darwin, who was an influence. What about Nietzsche, who, because James grew up the son of a theologian. Perhaps his most famous book is The Varieties of Religious Experience. How did he respond to Nietzsche's claim that God is dead?
You know, I never found any proof that he read Nietzsche or talked about him. This is very hard to believe, but there it is.
A philosopher at that time.
I had nothing to go on that. And what he would have done with that, he was not one to go around saying God is alive, because his idea of religion was not institutional, and it wasn't tied to a Christian God or a Jewish God or a Muslim Allah. It was tied to personal, individual religious belief.
What about his philosophy of pragmatism? He called it a new name for some old ways of thinking.
Yeah, he did.
So what are the basic principles of pragmatism?
That you judge events by their outcome, that you judge ideas. The meaning of an idea is what changes it can affect in your life or somebody else's life. In other words, origins of things don't have much to do with it, and intentions don't have much to do with it. It's really the fruits of something, not the roots.
You say he's the last American philosopher to connect with a mass audience. Why do you think that no one has been able to since? Is it where philosophy went?
Well, I think people have come pretty close. I think people like Eric Erickson and Robert Coles have reached a large audience with similarly complex ideas. And I think they sort of stand in his light in a way.
You begin the book with a story from the end of James's life, experiencing the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. What does that incident tell us about the man that he was?
Well, the thing about he was at Stanford during the 1906 earthquake, and as all the buildings on the Stanford campus collapsed and all this, his response to the earthquake was one of joy, admiration, glee, and delight. And he's like John Muir, who was caught in a landslide in the California mountains, and he ran toward it, not away from it.
John Muir must have been reading William James and his ideas of fear.
That's right. There may be a very close little family connection there. But James's response to the earthquake was one of he reveled in the sort of Dionysian power of the thing.
Now, you've written biographies of Thoreau, Emerson, and William James. Is it true that the next one is going to be about Omar Khayyam?
Yeah. I want to learn Farsi, and I want to study 11th century Persia and write a book about Omar Khayyam and two men he's supposed to have gone to school with, one who became the Old Man of the Mountains, the founder of the sect of the Assassins, and the other who became the Grand Vizier to the Sheikh Malik Shah. And I thought, having a government man and an evil genius of the mountains and an astronomer poet would make a nice grouping.
Well, it sounds like a great story, but it may even take you more than 10 years to do, especially if you have to learn Farsi.
It may indeed.
Are you on the way?
I'm starting. I don't have much Farsi yet. I had to learn the Arabic alphabet and learn how to start to read backward, and I can sometimes tell on the evening news if they're translating the Arabic correctly and giving
you
Muhammad. So it's a start, a very small start.
Robert D. Richardson's latest book, still in English, called William James in the Maelstrom of American Modernism. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I hope I'm here 10 years from now and we can talk about Omar Khayyam.
I sure hope so, too.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.